Good morning. This is Howell Jackson, and I'd like to welcome you to Lecture 6 of our Introduction to Financial Institutions lecture series. Today's lecture primarily concerns the regulation of lending limits, and we will be looking at not only the loan-to-one borrower rules under the federal system, but also the additional restrictions imposed on loans to insiders, and in particular, Regulation O and Section 23A and 23B of the Federal Reserve Act. But before we begin the primary topic of today's lecture, I'd like to say a few introductory comments following up on Lectures 4 and Lectures 5. In particular, I'd like to respond to two comments posted on the discussion groups for these two lectures. First, there was a posting in response to problem 320 by Guo Li. I think this comment does a good job answering the question posed by problem 320. And if any of the members of the class were confused by my lecture on this point, I would suggest you take a look at Guo Li's comment. Guo Li also made reference to the Basel requirements that have been implemented in China in recent years, and asked for my reaction to those regulatory standards. This is a topic that I touched upon briefly in the last class, but since there appears to be additional interest in the point, I have written some additional comments in response to Guo Li's posting, and I would invite members of the class who have a particular interest in that topic to take a look at those comments and to add their reactions as well. You'll find these comments in the discussion group for Lecture 4. The other comment posted under the code name Bright by one of the students in the class is a reaction to our discussion of the Windstar case. As you will recall, the Windstar case involved a series of transactions in which insolvent thrifts were merged into healthy organizations in exchange for various incentives from the federal government. And the decision that we looked at involved the potential liability of the federal government for changes in accounting standards implemented in 1989 by the U.S. Congress. In that case, as you will recall, the Supreme Court ruled that the federal government could be held responsible for losses imposed as a result of certain statutory changes. And as the Bright comment notes, the real issue in this case is who should bear the loss as a result of these changes in law. While I think the comment here is an interesting and important one, I think it also gives me an opportunity, which I'd like to take, to restate exactly how the Supreme Court's decision in the Windstar case applies in practice. In fact, there is a certain division of losses between the government and private parties implicit in the Windstar case. The private parties do bear some risks from changes in capital standards. In particular, the 1989 legislation, as well as subsequent acts of Congress in the United States, have generally raised the capital requirements in the past decade from roughly 4% or 6% up to 8% or more under current standards. Private parties have borne the risk of generally higher capital standards. They've had to increase the amount of capital invested in their depository institutions and indirectly faced higher costs as a result of those additional investments. That risk is borne by private parties. There have also been changes in the measurement of capital that have essentially imposed costs on private parties as well. In our last week's lecture, we discussed the restrictions on the amount of loan loss reserves that could be figured into Tier 2 capital prior to the reforms of 1989 and the Basel standards. All loan loss reserves could figure into Tier 2 capital or secondary capital, as it was called before 1989. That's no longer the case. This change in measurement creates a cost, and that cost is borne by private parties who have to come up with other sorts of capital requirements. You might also say that the risk-based capital standards themselves, which impose higher capital standards on certain kinds of investments, such as commercial loans, have imposed costs, and those costs have been borne by private parties. What the Windstar case establishes, as the Bright comment notes, is that certain other risks are borne by the federal government in the United States, and in particular the elimination of supervisory goodwill is a cost on certain parties, that is, parties that entered into particular kinds of transactions with the federal government, that will not be borne by private parties, but will instead be borne by the government. I think that what was critical to the Supreme Court's decision in this case was the fact that the elimination of supervisory goodwill was a really targeted action by the federal government that would affect a relatively limited number of institutions, 120 institutions, I think, is the number that's usually used here, and is therefore different than other changes implemented by the reforms of 1989, which were of a more general application. The changes, for example, in the use of loan loss reserves as capital applied to all institutions, not just a handful. And the fact that the government was targeting particular transactions, I think, really influenced the Supreme Court's decision in this case. From my perspective, one of the interesting things, at least as a matter of constitutional law, is the question of whether the government could have gotten much the same result by operating in a slightly less direct way. For example, if they had simply given supervisory goodwill a higher risk weighting than other assets, would that have made a difference? For example, if they had allowed institutions to keep supervisory goodwill on the balance sheet but just give it a higher weighting, would that have satisfied the Supreme Court that the contract was being honored, but that some recognition was being taken by Congress that supervisory goodwill is a more risky asset than, say, commercial loans? We don't really know the answer to this question because, of course, Congress did not proceed in this way. But it does seem at least plausible to me that much the same result could have been accomplished if Congress had proceeded a little more subtly in its legislation. Now, one of the interesting questions posed by the Bright comment is whether or not the government is a good bearer of risk in this situation. The implication of the posting is that the government is not a good bearer of risk. I'm not sure I entirely agree with that. The government has the ability to spread the risk of these losses over a large number of parties, that is, over the entire federal tax base, and there is certainly the capacity to risk spread under these circumstances. There is also, I think, it's important to understand, a cost associated with the Supreme Court deciding the case the other way. If it had said that the government was free to change the rules under these circumstances, it would have imposed a cost on the government in the future when it would be trying to dispose of other failed depository institutions or really engage in any other kind of contractual arrangement with private parties. If there was the chance that, on the one hand, a government agency could enter into such a contract and Congress could turn around a year or two or three later and change the contract without any cost, that would present a real problem for future contract making by the government. Parties couldn't credibly make arrangements with the government or make certain kinds of arrangements with the government without fearing to some extent that those contracts would be changed unilaterally in the future. Generally speaking, one would expect this uncertainty to raise the government's cost of doing business in the future and therefore having an undesirable effect on the operation of government. So I think this concern about future contracting was also in the back of the Supreme Court's mind and is a further justification, I think, for imposing risks on the government in this particular kind of targeted legislative change. Finally, I'd like to say a word about one of the key issues in this case, which we didn't discuss very much in the last class, but the question of damages. What is the right measure of damages to the private parties in this case? A superficial answer is, well, they should get back the money equal to the amount of supervisory goodwill they were denied as a result of the legislation. It's not entirely clear to me, however, that this is an appropriate measure of damages. After all, the government never promised to give them the money. They only promised to allow them to count supervisory goodwill as a part of their capital requirements. So what the parties essentially had was an agreement to have effectively lower capital requirements for these institutions. The cost really should be the cost of raising additional capital in the capital markets, the cost of essentially issuing new stock or raising capital in some other way in the private market. And of course, if you read the case carefully, the parties were not allowed to keep the supervisory goodwill forever. Rather, it would be amortized, that is, worked off over a period of years, 30 years or 40 years. So over time, the value of the supervisory goodwill was going to decline in any event. This should further limit the amount of damages imposed on the government. Interestingly, just this past week, actually on Friday, April 9th, there was another decision in the Windstar case, and I have posted as a note for this lecture a Wall Street Journal article about this case in which the federal government was ordered to pay damages of close to $1 billion for the first of 120 test cases. The decision I have not yet read yet, it's not yet publicly available, but it will be shortly, does suggest that the damage awards in this case are going to be quite high and will likely, when all the litigation is over, exceed $10 billion in all and maybe be substantially higher than that. But this is a case that is pending, and the issue of damages is the one which is being worked out in the federal system right now. So those of you who are interested, I invite you to take a look at the article that I posted, and I will create a link to the decision itself when that is available. I think, however, just for our purposes of discussion, the Windstar case is quite an interesting case as a matter of regulatory policy, and I suspect that the perspectives of the U.S. courts, and particularly the Supreme Court in the Windstar decision, is quite different than the perspective of Chinese courts in similar kinds of situations. The Windstar case reflects a very strong commitment to property interests. It's a difficult case, and there are those who disagree with the Supreme Court's decision in this particular case, but it does reflect a tradition in U.S. jurisprudence which has been an important part of our economic system for some time and has implications for regulatory policy, as the Windstar case demonstrates. Let's turn now to the primary discussion of today's lecture, which is the lending limit rules themselves. Lending restrictions are, I think, best understood as a further form of activity restrictions for depository institutions. Earlier in this lecture series, in lecture 2 and 3, we discussed activities restrictions. These rules govern the kind of investments that depository institutions can make. And generally speaking, the goal of these restrictions is to prevent depository institutions from undertaking excessively risky activities or activities which the supervisory process cannot adequately monitor. In addition to those general rules restricting the category investments depository institutions can make. There are a specialized set of rules limiting the amount depository institutions can invest in any particular transaction of a permissible sort. Sometimes lending limits are referred to as diversification requirements. They require that the assets of the depository institutions be diversified according to set standards. And comparable regulatory structures can be seen in all other fields of financial institution regulation in the United States. For example, in the area of insurance law, in pension plans, in investment companies, there are comparable restrictions imposing diversification requirements on the institutions involved. In this lecture series, we will not consider diversification requirements in the other areas, but rather we'll focus on them exclusively in our discussion of depository institutions. What I would like to do in today's lecture is discuss how these diversification requirements operate, to look at the logic underlying this sort of regulatory structure, and then to discuss some of the issues of implementation that arise when imposing diversification requirements. So what the lending limits do is place restrictions on the amount of funds that can be lent from a federal bank, a federally insured bank, to an individual borrower. I think the best way to see how these rules operate in practice is to take a look at a specific problem. And I would like to begin with problem 3.5 on page 145 of the casebook. I'll go through this problem relatively quickly, just to give you a sense of how the lending rules operate in the United States. In this particular case, the question is whether or not a bank can make a $34 million loan to a borrower that intends to use trucks as collateral for the loan, so a standard commercial sort of loan. Well, if you read through the materials assigned for this class, what you'll see is there is a statutory standard for the amount of loans an individual bank can make. The basic rules are found in Section 84 of Title 12, which is a section of the National Banking Act. So these are the specific rules developed to govern national banks. And reading for this provision, what you'll see is that the amount of credit that a national bank can offer any individual person is limited to a percentage of the bank's unimpaired capital and surplus. And that percentage is 15%. So the amount of capital, in addition to establishing whether or not a bank is in compliance with capital rules, also determines its lending limit. There are also provisions, which we'll discuss in a second, which allow for additional lending based on the collateral offered. But for this initial problem, we need only concern ourselves with the first provision of this statutory standard. In the case we're discussing, the bank has $230 million worth of capital and surplus. There are actually definitions which help you calculate this amount, and those of you who are interested can take a look at the statutory supplement for this area of the law. And in particular, you should look at the regulatory rules for the lending limits, which are found on page 225 of the statutory supplement. They're part 32 of the Comptroller of the Currency's regulations. But the way they work is to look at the capital, as I was mentioning, and then specific limits are set for the amount of capital that can be lent to any individual borrower. In particular, the limitation is 15% of capital, which is equal to $34.5 million in this particular case. So the lending limit established by statute is slightly more than the amount proposed to be lent to this particular borrower, and thus the loan is in compliance with the statutory standard. In fact, most banks in the United States would have internal limits more strict than the statutory requirements, in part to ensure that they don't inadvertently overstep the boundaries. But assuming that there was not an internal limit stricter than the statutory standards for this particular bank, it could make the loan without violating the loan-to-one borrower rules. The problem then continues to ask, what about additional loans for larger sums, and in particular, a loan for $80 million secured by various kinds of collateral? Well, the answer is, depending on the type of collateral involved, the bank could make a greater loan than $34 million, but it's not clear that the bank would be permitted to make a full $80 million loan with all the types of collateral being proposed in this problem. Again, let me work through the exercise quickly, beginning with the statutory provision at issue. As I mentioned before, the second paragraph of Section 84A has a provision for collateralization. In essence, what this provision allows is for banks to lend an additional 10% of their capital and unimpaired surplus, provided the loan is fully secured by something called readily marketable collateral, having a market value at least in the amount of the funds to be lent, that is, to cover the extra amount to be lent. This is a so-called 100% collateralization rule. Now we're in a position to try to answer the questions posed in problem 3.5. As the problem explains, there are a variety of different kinds of collateral the borrower could offer to support an additional amount of lending, beginning with $55 million worth of IBM stock. Would that be permissible additional collateral under the rules we just read? Well, you'd have to actually go back and read these rules rather carefully. But if you did, you would find that IBM stock, which is a traded security on the New York Stock Exchange, does qualify as readily marketable collateral. And it increases the lending limit of this particular bank by 10% of capital and surplus, or roughly $23 million additional dollars. So with this sort of IBM stock, the borrower could increase the loan, not up to the full $80 million requested here, but could get another $23 million for a total loan of about $57.5 million. What if the collateral were not IBM stock, but paintings or diamonds of some sort? Well, again, this would require resort to the actual regulatory structure, which appears in the statutory supplement. But one of the things that you would discover if you read this through is that, at least under U.S. rules, paintings and diamonds did not constitute readily marketable collateral. There's not a ready market in these instruments. They could not easily be disposed of in the event of default, and therefore collateral of this sort does not increase the permissible lending of banks under our current regulatory structure. The third alternative in this case is T. And as the problem explains, this is T, not loose T, but T in some sort of warehouse under some kind of bonding arrangement. And again, a resort to the rules, in particular, a resort to Section 32.3B1 of 12 CFR, which you can find in the statutory supplement, indicates that there is a special lending rule for this kind of collateral, which is associated with trading transactions. And in fact, somewhat counterintuitively, banks are permitted to lend up to 35% of capital and surplus for loans of this sort, which does actually exceed the $80 million required in this particular loan. So the answer to this problem, if you worked it through, is the bank could only make the full $80 million loan if the collateral were of the sort provided for in the special lending rules I've mentioned on the slide here. Stepping back for a minute from this very quick review of our lending rules, you should ask yourself for a moment, is there a logic to this regulatory structure? Well, I think the answer is yes, there is a basic logic that is actually reflected in most diversification requirements. The larger the institution, measured as the amount of capital it has, the more that it's allowed to lend to individual borrowers. Sometimes you see diversification requirements based on a percentage of assets, so that no more than 1% or 2% or 5% of assets can be invested in any particular entity or lent to any individual borrower. In the case of the bank lending rules in the United States, the percentage is based on capital and surplus, But since capital and surplus must, as we know now, be a percentage of assets, they are indirectly based on the size of an institution's assets in practice. I think the further justification for making a direct link to capital is that a bank could suffer a complete loss on an individual borrower's loan and still have 85%, presumably, of its prior capital after the transaction. So five or even six loans could be completely worthless, and the bank would still not quite be technically insolvent, although it would be relatively close if the loans all were at the 15% of capital and surplus level. The other basic feature of the lending limits is if there is security of an acceptable sort that is presumably readily marketable, then the lending limits are increased somewhat, but not eliminated entirely. So the relatively modest increase of an additional 10% for readily marketable collateral that you see in Section 84 is an acknowledgement that collateral reduces risk for lending institutions, but does not eliminate that risk entirely. The collateral could unexpectedly become worthless. It could be lost or stolen in some way. So the presence of additional collateral does not eliminate the lending limits, but it does allow for their liberalization to a certain degree. So I think generally there's a logic to the structure. One might question whether there really is justification for the more liberal lending rules for T that we just discussed as opposed to traded securities, and one could quibble about this distinctions, but the general structure of the rules, I think, are largely sensible. There are, I think, however, some deeper questions about the structure. One question you might want to think of is, does it make sense to have such relatively strict rules? 15% of capital is a relatively small amount of money compared to the total assets of the bank. Is it necessary to require such substantial amount of diversification for a lending institution? Assume, for example, a bank has capital and surplus equal to 10% of its assets. The basic lending limit rules say that only 15% of that 10%, or 1.5% of its entire asset base, can be lent to an individual borrower. Even if the institution lent up to the maximum to individual borrowers, that means that there would be 60 loans in the institution's portfolio. Now, those of you who've studied financial economics are probably aware that a portfolio does not have to be divided into 60 separate pieces to get all of the gains available from diversification. Generally speaking, economic theory suggests that diversification into 30 separate pieces is adequate, and in fact, much of the gains of diversification can be gained with a division into 10 separate investments. So, in some way, you could say that the lending limits require excessive diversification based on economic theory. On the other hand, I think it's probably more accurate to say that most lending institutions are not working under the conditions of perfect competition or perfectly independent investment opportunities that economic theory usually presumes. In fact, there is a lot of inadequacy in the diversifications of most depository institutions in the United States, and I would suspect that that is true also of lending of institutions in China as well. And the reason for this inadequate diversification is most depository institutions have some degree of specialization. That is, they tend to lend a disproportionate amount of their funds to borrowers who may be independent of each other in terms of ownership and economic activity, but are engaged in the same line of business, such as engaged in agricultural activities oil and gas extraction or certain kinds of manufacturing fields. And therefore, there is not independence in the returns that these individual borrowers obtain, and also not independence in the risks that banks or other depository institutions undertake when they lend to these borrowers. Furthermore, there is also a certain degree of geographic concentration in most depository institutions' business. They tend to lend more locally than nationally, and so they have greater economic risks tied to the region of the country in which they do business. So, under one purely theoretical perspective of the lending limits, you could say that they're too strict, but in practice, there are many reasons to think that there is inadequate diversification of various kinds or for various reasons. And so the relative strictness of the lending limits might make some sense. In the United States, at least, there are probably other reasons that explain the strictness of the lending limits beyond the purely economic ones. As the casebook suggests in various places, one of the functions of the lending limits is to ensure the spreading of credit to a number of different borrowers, to prevent the banks from simply lending to one individual entity within a region and requiring them to spread their credit around to a greater degree than they might otherwise choose to do. There may also be some effort to prevent banks from lending excessive amounts of their assets to any individual firm out of fear that they might thereby gain control over the firm, even though they don't have an investment. If their lending is large enough, this might create this sort of nexus between banking and commerce that we discussed earlier in this lecture series and is of concern historically in the United States and probably in other jurisdictions as well. So the lending limits, I think, do double duty. They are primarily diversification requirements, but there are some other considerations at work that explain their strictness in the United States. What I'd like to do now is turn from the economic theory of lending limits and talk about some practical problems of implementing lending limits. This is an area where, at least in the United States, lawyers have a good deal to say both about the design and the compliance with regulatory rules of this sort. What we observe in the United States is certain recurring problems of difficulty in implementing regulatory structures of this sort. There are a number of different kinds of problems we discover, but the two principal ones that I'd like to discuss today are the definition of a single borrower. What constitutes a single borrower for purposes of the lending limits? And what do we mean by a loan or an extension of credit? As you will see over the next few minutes, our regulatory structure is not simply a set of rules about diversification requirements, but it's a number of implementing provisions designed to make sure that the rules are complied with in actual practice, notwithstanding the efforts on the part of private parties to evade these restrictions. Now, to illustrate this point, let me go back to the problem that we began the hour discussing, which is problem 3.5. And the initial problem in that case involved a loan of $34 million to a company with trucks as collateral. And as I discussed, the basic lending rules allow for this kind of loan. The lending limit for this institution is about $34.5 million, and so the loan proposed here is within the limit, although at the upper level it would be permitted. Suppose the borrower here wanted to make a second loan from the bank, wanted to borrow another $34 million. And suppose for some reason the bank were inclined to make the loan. We can imagine a lot of reasons why that might be. There may be ongoing relationships between the bank and the borrower, and the bank simply wants to continue doing business. The bank may be concerned that if the borrower goes to another depository institution for funds, they may lose business in the future. Or even possibly the bank may be concerned about the value of its initial loan because the company might be running into trouble, and the bank might want to lend additional money, not just to get a return on that money, but to protect its initial investment. Now, under the rules we've discussed so far, the lending limit is $34.5 million for this bank, and an additional $34 million would not be allowed. The collateral here, trucks, doesn't qualify for any of these special rules and also is not readily marketable collateral. So a direct loan to the borrower would not be permitted. But what if the bank made a loan to the president of the company, or perhaps to an affiliated company, or perhaps to a customer that was going to use the funds to purchase services from the company, and the funds were transferred in this way, not to the borrower, but to other entities or individuals that had some sort of relationship with the borrower? Well, this is precisely what I refer to as the definition of a borrower problem. If you think about it, it's quite clear that if a proxy borrower could be created to funnel the funds back to the first borrower, the bank would be assuming exactly the same risks as it would assume if the money were lent directly to the company in the first place. And as a result, our lending rules in the United States have gradually evolved to embrace a number of related borrowers, related parties in the definition of individual borrower. Well, if you look over to the statutory supplement in section 32.2A, you'll see that the term borrower for purposes of the loan to one borrower rules has a special definition, and it creates two different tests. One is called the direct benefit test, and the other is called the common enterprise test. In essence, these two tests define when loans to different individuals will be aggregated. If you loan money to one person and it's used for the direct benefit of another person, then the transactions will be aggregated into a single lending limit borrower. Similarly, if two borrowers are engaged in a common enterprise, and there are some definitions here in 32.5B defining common enterprise, then they too will be defined to be a single borrower for purposes of the one-to-one borrower rules. And finally, there's an additional basis for common enterprise, which essentially is an authorization for the OCC, the Comptroller of the Currency, to determine on a case-by-case basis whether there is a common enterprise in a particular case. I'm not going to deal with the common enterprise and direct benefit tests in any great detail myself here, but I would mention that they are discussed in the Jackson-Simon casebook and the pages indicated above. And if you want to see an application of them in a judicial case, the Del Junco case on page 147 is a fairly straightforward enforcement action in which a party engaged in just the sort of transaction I was describing above. The corporation was up to the lending limit, and so they used an individual officer of the corporation to obtain an additional loan, which was funneled directly into the corporate treasury. This was a fairly flagrant violation of the loan-to-one borrower rules, but it was not that uncommon a transaction in periods of financial stress. A slightly more complex illustration of this kind of problem occurs in problem 3.6 on page 150. And if any members of the class are particularly interested in this area of the law, I'd invite you to attempt to answer problem 3.6 on the discussion page, and I will react to your individual answers. For purposes of our discussion here, though, I just want you to appreciate the kind of complexity that goes into a real regulatory system in an area such as this. It's not simply enough that you require institutions to be diversified. You must, with some care, define what an individual borrower is. Otherwise, there will be no effect to the regulatory restrictions that you are trying to implement. Of course, on top of having an elaborate set of definitions of the sort that we're looking at here, you need to have some sort of examination structure and enforcement structure to detect violations. And so the actual operation of a regulatory structure of this sort is even more complicated than this review of regulatory provisions indicates. Now, there's another set of practical problems in applying lending limits, which I would describe as the definition of loan problem. What is it that we mean when we say a loan, or actually in the case of the regulatory provisions we're looking at, an extension of credit? To see this kind of a problem, imagine the same case that we're looking at. A borrower wants an additional loan, and we're assuming that the loan is an additional $34 million, which is over the lending limit. The bank has concluded that it can't make the loan through other nominee borrowers, the president or affiliated companies, but it comes up with another strategy. What if it allows for the borrower to sell some securities? Imagine that the borrower has some securities that it doesn't need right now, and the bank buys them from the borrower with an agreement that the borrower will purchase those securities back in a year for a price that is presumably somewhat higher. So essentially, the bank engages in a purchase and resell agreement with the borrower. This has the effect of getting money to the borrower. It sends $34 million in money, which must be used to repurchase the security at the end of the year. But in the interim, the borrower has an additional $34 million of cash with which to engage in its business. This kind of transaction, which is often referred to as a repurchase agreement, is something that has evolved in the United States and other markets. Is it a loan for purposes of the lending limits? Well, again, you need to look over at the definitional provisions. What you'll see if you read them through in Section 32.2J1 is that loans and extensions of a credit do include something called contractual commitments to advance funds, as well as a bank's purchase of securities subject to an agreement that the seller will repurchase the securities at the end of a stated period. So subsection 3 here expressly includes repurchase agreements that are in essence a collateralized form of loan. Another kind of transaction that a bank might consider would be to find another lender, a second bank, to make the $34 million loan. And if that second bank were not comfortable with the borrower for some reason, for example, if the borrower were on the verge of financial difficulty, the first bank might make a commitment to guarantee the repayment of the loan. That is, the first bank might guarantee to the second bank that this second loan will be repaid. Is that an acceptable way of getting additional credit to the borrower? Well, again, you need to look at the definition provision, but if you read this provision and the cross sections that it includes, what you'll see is that loans and extensions of a credit include contractual commitments to advance funds. Then there's another cross reference to paragraph F, which itself says making a standby letter of credit, which is a form of guarantee, will be considered a contractual commitment, which in turn will be considered a loan or extension of credit for purposes of the loan-to-one borrower rules. So the contractual provisions are picked, the guarantee provisions that I was hypothesizing. So the answer is the bank cannot simply guarantee the loan from another bank because, as a practical matter, that means that the economic risk of the second loan is borne by the first bank, and the goal of the diversification requirement is not satisfied. Let me look at one final way in which banking institutions sometimes try to get around the loan-to-one-borrower rules. This is through the process that is known as a loan participation. Under the loan participation, a bank will sell an interest in a loan to another bank or series of banks. In this case, assume that the first bank sells its entire interest in the first loan to a second bank. The question then is, can the first bank then make a new loan for $34 million, that is, a new loan up to its full lending limit, to the borrower? Well, the answer to this question really depends on the nature of the loan participation transaction. If the loan is sold free and clear, that is, if the loan is sold to the second bank without any promises, without any agreements to repurchase, without any obligations to ensure the performance of the first loan, then the bank no longer has any economic interest in the transaction, and it is free to make an additional loan up to its lending limit. On the other hand, if the sale of the loan entails additional contractual obligations to guarantee its performance or to repurchase the loan if it fails to meet up to its literal potential, then the first bank has retained an interest in that loan and an additional lending authority would not be authorized, at least as the transactions are undertaken in the United States. As it turns out, in the U.S. Financial market, loan participations are a relatively common way for banks to reduce their economic investments in particular loans. And in fact, many banks in the United States specialize in loan participations and make many more loans than they could ever hold on their balance sheet and make much larger loans than would be permitted under the loan-to-one-borrower rules. If you read through the casebook, those of you who are interested in this area, you will see discussions of loan participations following the loan-to-one-borrower rules. And in particular, you will see a very interesting case which explores the question about whether loan participations should be treated as ordinary banking transactions or whether they really constitute a kind of special security which would be subject to the federal rules of securities regulation. This is an area that we will touch upon later on in the lecture series, and it's an interesting point in which banking regulation does butt up against the structure of securities regulation in this country. At this point, however, I think we should leave the basic lending limit rules. And let me just say as a conclusion to this part of the lecture that what I wanted you to see here is an illustration of some of the problems of implementation. As I mentioned earlier, there are a number of different illustrations of this sort that I could have developed. And if you read through the regulatory definitions in this area, I think you can get a sense of the complexity of the rules that we apply in this field in the United States. And I will not get into this great detail in other areas of the course, but I thought that at least in one area, you should see in a little greater detail the way in which our regulatory rules actually are applied. What I'd like to do now is turn to other lending restrictions moving from the general rules, which apply to all loans to any borrower, to the particular and more strict rules that apply to loans to so-called insiders. As you'll see in this final section of the hour's lecture, we have actually two different systems of restrictions for insiders, a specialized set of rules for executive officers, and personnel who work in the banks on a day-to-day basis, so-called Regulation O, and then a further set of rules regarding loans and other transactions with affiliates. So it is to these insider trading rules that I would like to turn at this point. Conceptually, the way I think about these rules is that they offer a extra layer of protection. We've already talked about the general lending rules to ordinary borrowers. And what we're looking at here is a secondary set of rules, which has to do with, in the first instance, officers, directors, and principal shareholders. That's what is covered by so-called Regulation O. So let's now briefly look at how Regulation O operates. The basic provisions can be found in Section 215.4 of the Code of Federal Regulations, which appears in your statutory supplement. In essence, these rules apply to any insider of a bank or insider of its affiliates. So these are defined terms, which you can see elsewhere in Regulation O. Briefly, the definition, which is in subsection 2H, includes executive officers, which would be the leading management, directors, that is, members of the board of directors, principal shareholders, which, as we'll see in a second, are shareholders with at least a 10% ownership interest, and then any other related interest of such person. So there's a general category of individuals covered, plus related interest. Related interest can be thought of companies that are controlled by an insider. So if a director owns a business in the community, that would be a related interest of the insider, and it would be covered by the terms of Regulation O. As I mentioned, principal shareholders are covered. These are shareholders typically that have at least a 10% interest in a class of voting securities, so usually means they own at least 10% of the company. And as you can see, again, if you read through here, one of the details, of which there are many I haven't put on the board, but one detail is individuals' holdings are aggregated with the holdings of his immediate family. So if his spouse or children own shares, they're included in his shares, and you get a total holding. If that total holding is over 10%, Regulation O applies. So conceptually, what Regulation O is a specialized rule about bank loans, really, and for a certain group of people. Those are the people that are defined as insiders, and as I've just mentioned, that includes directors, principal shareholders, executive officers, and related interests. So those are the coverage entities. What does the rule provide? Well, you could read in our casebook, or you can just look at the next slide. The basic provisions are quite interesting. Essentially, there's a requirement that the terms of the loan be comparable to those prevailing for other transactions of the bank at the time, and that there not be any excessive payment of any excessive risk of repayment. So they have to be typical loans at ordinary interest rates for the kinds of transactions involved. So a general rule of comparability. The second set of the requirements, though, I think is quite interesting. It's a prior approval rule that essentially, except for relatively trivial amounts of loans, requires that the loan be approved in advance by a majority of the entire board of directors, which would, I think, it's fair to say for most banking institutions be a specialized procedure. Usually the approval of credit would be delegated further down into the management of the firm, but loans to insiders have to be approved by the board of directors, and the interested party, who will almost always be a member of the board of directors, is not allowed to participate in that voting, either directly or indirectly. So Regulation O sets up a procedural mechanism to ensure that insiders do not take advantage of their position with respect to the depository institution. Formally, subsection A here prohibits preferential treatment, but that is buttressed by the prior approval rules that I put up here. This is a kind of procedural protection. It requires that a paper record be created. It makes it more easy, amongst other things, for examiners after the fact to review these transactions to make sure that there has not been any abuse of position. If you read further into the rules, you'll see that there are some special additional rules for executive officers, more stringent requirements for the management themselves than the board of directors. The reason for this is that, at least in the United States, oftentimes the directors are business people from the local community. Oftentimes they are good customers of the bank who have some sort of banking relationship, and the theory is we don't want to disrupt those relationships excessively, but for the most part the executive officers are supposed to be working for the banks and typically don't have such outside interests that will require credit facilities from the organizations. So a slightly stricter set of rules for executive officers. For those of you who are interested in this area, you can take a look at more detail about Regulation O in the casebook. The page is assigned for this week's lecture. There's also a problem 3.8 on page 153, that explores some additional complexities of Regulation O. Any members of the class who would like to take their hand at this problem are welcome to, and post your response on the discussion page, and I will try to react to it as best I can. So we've now discussed the basic lending limits for all borrowers, specialized rules for officers, directors, and principal shareholders. Now it is time to turn to the final set of lending restrictions, which I refer to in my slides as Section 23A and 23B of the Federal Reserve Act. These are the rules that apply to so-called affiliates of insured banks. These are, as we'll see, the strictest restrictions, and they apply to a subset of individuals who are already covered by Regulation O, and I will explain in a second how that works. Essentially, what you should understand is that Section 23A and Section 23B are about loans and transactions between banks and affiliates, that is, firms that are under common control. And the control test I don't put up in this lecture, but generally speaking, it requires 25% common ownership and would, of course, apply to the most typical holding company structure in the United States, which is a company with a 100% interest in a bank that will have some affiliated firms. Now, as we'll discuss next week, these affiliates tend not to be commercial firms, because there is a prohibition between the affiliation of depository institutions and commercial firms, for the most part, in the United States. But there are affiliates that are not themselves depository institutions, that engage in other financial type activities, and could potentially seek to borrow funds from affiliated banks. Section 23A and also Section 23B regulate these transactions. And this is, I think, a critical set of provisions, because if they were not regulated, there is a risk that banks would provide resources, make below-market loans, extend credit on preferential terms, or generally move value from the bank to affiliates. What this would, in essence, do is lower the effective capital of the bank. And as we've discussed already, the capital requirements are imposed to make depository institutions have more capital than they would ordinarily want to have, or that they would otherwise want to have. And if you didn't have careful regulation of transactions between depository institutions and their affiliates, the excess capital, the excess value, would simply leak out, or would be prone to leak out. And that's what 23A and 23B are designed to stop. The rules are complex. They appear in Section 371C and C1 of the U.S. Code, also in your statutory supplements. If you read through, what the rules say is a bank can lend up to 10% of its capital and surplus to an affiliate, or up to 20% to all affiliates. A covered transaction includes a number of things, but you can think of it here as including primarily extensions of credit. The bank can't lend more than 10% to its affiliate, any individual affiliate, or more than 20% of its capital and surplus to all of its affiliates. And if you'll see down below, subsection 2, there is this gloss on the rule which aggregates transactions that are used for the benefit of that affiliate. This is comparable to the definition of borrower in the lending limit rules. If transactions are made with a third party and the funds are transferred to the affiliate, that's deemed to be a transaction with the affiliate. So this looks, in, to a certain extent, like the lending limits. And you might say to yourself, well, the lending limits already preclude the bank from lending to any party more than 15% of capital and surplus, so this looks relatively similar. But if you read on through the rule, what you see is a collateralization requirement. And that's found in Section 23A as well, a little further on. What this says is each loan to an affiliate has got to be collateralized by, well, it depends on the type of collateral, but depending on the type, collateral equal to either 100%, 110%, 120%, or 130% of the value of the loan. So 23A says, essentially, you can make only a relatively small amount of loans to your affiliated entities, and they have to be fully collateralized. And what this essentially does is dramatically reduce the risk of transactions between banks and their affiliates. The amount of the loans are greatly restricted, and the collateralization requirements, if you actually work them through, are extremely severe. The provisions, and this is now jumping over to 23B, also extend to other kinds of transactions besides loans. And what they have here is any kind of service contract, any kind of purchase of asset, regardless of whether there's a repurchase agreement, is covered by 23B. And there is a general requirement that all of these transactions be on terms that are comparable to prevailing comparable transactions with non-affiliated parties, and that they have to be undertaken in a way that does not impose additional risk or credit risk on the bank itself. So this is somewhat similar to what you see in Regulation O, but it is carefully policed in the examination reports, probably more carefully policed than the transactions covered by Regulation O, and forms one of the most important pieces of our regulatory structure. As I did before, let me just say there is more discussion of Sections 23A and 23B in the casebook. There's also a problem set which you're invited to take a look at. Even though the coverage in the casebook is relatively modest for this provision, I want to emphasize to you that this provision on affiliate transactions is one that is taken extremely seriously by bank examiners in the United States. In the past, when there have been instances of failures on a widespread basis in the United States, they have also been associated with violations of Section 23A and 23B. When we turn to our discussion of enforcement mechanisms, you'll see that a number of the enforcement provisions are written specifically to deal with these rules, and violations of 23A and 23B are likely to have the severest of regulatory sanctions, including in certain circumstances, criminal sanctions for violations. It's felt generally that these provisions are at the core of the regulatory structure. As I mentioned before, they're essential to the enforcement of the capital standards, and we police them as strictly as any provisions in our regulatory system today. This completes our discussion of lending limits. As you'll recall from the hour, we've discussed three different sets of lending limits, the general rules for regular borrowers, some things about their basic application, as well as a discussion of difficulties of implementation and their theoretical underpinnings. I have then relatively quickly discussed the restrictions on loans to insiders. These are quite important rules, though, and I would urge you to read the materials here carefully since they're such an important part of our regulatory structure. This concludes a sixth lecture in the Introduction to Financial Institutions lecture series. I hope you have enjoyed the lecture. Next week, we will turn to the regulation of organizational structure, that is, regulation of bank holding companies and bank affiliates owned in holding company structures. I know that a number of you are interested in the Japanese model of financial conglomerates, and next week's lecture will deal with the U.S. rules for such organizations. I look forward to seeing you then. Goodbye.